Survival podcast is always one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things that we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, July the 30th, 2026, and this is episode 3876 as we chug on toward eventually 4,000 episodes of the podcast. I got a good one for you today. It is, of course, a Thursday. That means there's no video version of this one. It's audio only, just like we were for, audio only for, 12 years, originating back in 2008. For those that are new here, 2008, June the 20th to be exact, I climbed in my little car on my way to my office up in a place called Frisco, Texas. And I took a little MP3 player and a Plantronics headset and did episode one of this show, and it turned into my life's work. So a little advice here. If you feel called to do something, do it. We all only get so much dash in our lives. The dash is the hyphen they put between the year you were born and the year you draw your last breath when you die. And that's what you get. And your dash shrinks daily. No matter how long-lived you turn out to be, every day you have less dash than you started with. So if there's something needs doing, something you feel called to do, get doing it. You never know where it's going to lead until you take a shot. Anyway, with that in mind, let's go ahead and tell you what we're going to be talking about today and who we're going to hear from. We're going to hear from Dr. Ron Paul today, leading off like we usually do on these shows in the Liberty Report highlight for the week. But, you know, since we form this partnership with the Ron Paul Liberty Report, and we bring on one of their segments every week, prepared for us. By the way, thank you, Chris Rossini, who does that for us. We've had a few times where we've had people on the show, technically, I guess, anyway, even though it's a canned segment they send me, that have never been on before. Well, how about Rand Paul? I didn't say Ron, I said Rand Paul, who just did a great job of showing what an ass clown Anthony Fauci is. Don't worry, I'll be talking about that next week. But Ron and Rand here team up, and they talk about a $1.5 million military budget. And Rand is really concerned about the danger of destroying the dollar. All I can say is the eventual demise of the dollar can be accelerated by this, but we're not going to destroy the dollar because the dollar has been destroyed. And when we listen together and hear what Rand has to say, I'll maybe throw a little bit more in. Then Carrie Brown will talk about finding, harvesting, and using elderberry. Nick Ferguson will talk about a problem you do not want to have. I have not listened to his segment yet, so I'll listen and see if there's anything I can add to it, because I have one thing that may be helpful, something I did myself this year for a different problem, but one that's just as frustrating, Bermuda grass. So we'll talk about that with Nick. And then Chef Ken Daniels is going to talk about cooking oyster mushrooms and not having them turn out like rubber, along with something called mushroom water and what you might want that for. Then Andy McCann will talk about dealing with plantar fasciitis, and he has three things you can try as far as products: a pair of shoes, a pair of inserts, and something called lemongrass oil. I have an addition to this one, because I actually dealt with this problem early this year. It didn't actually last very long, but it was, I'll save it, but it was very painful. It was very frustrating. And when it first started, it did not make any sense to me at all. When I explain what happened, I guess you'll understand. And then I'm finally going to do something, because I have to, because it's about to happen, and I keep getting asked about it. And every time I give my opinion on it, and my opinion is basically, I don't have anything to say about the ideology here. I just don't think it's going to work, because from a technical standpoint, it really can't. And of course, I'm talking about the BIP 110. That is the Bitcoin Improvement Protocol 110. And this is a concept of applying a filter to Bitcoin to reduce spam. I'm going to tell you today why I don't believe it's even possible for this to get adopted. Why I think it's basically just a tantrum by people who didn't get their way. That doesn't mean that I disagree with what they want. If I could give them what they wanted tomorrow, I would do it. I'm going to talk about why the expansion of data in something called op return was actually a solution to the problem they think they're trying to solve now. Why BIP 110 won't stop spam anyway, because we had it before, and they've already admitted it won't stop it. right? This is an ideological argument, but I'm also going to tell you something, and this is what gets me insulted. And I mean, I've been called a pedo protector. I have been called a suit coiner. You guys that have listened to me for a long time know I've been in Bitcoin since 2012. I've been called a Bitcoin tourist. That's a new one. These guys are coordinated like a left-wing lunatic machine did during the COVID years. And it's because they're frustrated and angry. And I understand why, but it doesn't alter reality. So I'm going to tell you why it's 99.9% likely that it'll fail. And I really think that number is more like 99.99999, unless everybody wakes up and changes their mind someday for no reason at all. That's always possible. So I'll leave that 0.0001 chance. And then I'm going to talk about what you should do about this. The answer is mostly nothing. And I'm going to talk about what it would mean if plebs with mostly non-monetary nodes can force a change on Bitcoin. And when I explain that, I'll explain why it's just a tantrum. It's a tantrum led by a gentleman named Luke and his followers. And I may even say some negative things about these people today, the individuals, not the people that are trying to articulate themselves and failing to do so, but the ringing monkey shouting and yelling at people on social media. If I do drop an insult or two on those people, just understand I don't want to insult anybody. It doesn't deserve it. But imagine I said, and I've been told already, you said not to do this, and here you go doing it. Imagine I said that I don't believe it's okay to punch somebody in the face. And then somebody came up to me and punched me in the face multiple times. And after about the fifth time, I hauled off and cocked them good. And they said, you said you're not for hitting people in the face. That's how I feel about that. So, and then I'm going to give you guys, if you want to know more, I'm going to try to keep this very easy to understand, non-technical, use analogy and what have you. If you want the best deep analysis by someone like me, meaning that if I could make every monkey JPEG picture go away, Ordinal go away, spam go away, and make Bitcoin 100% pure monetary network by waving a wand, I would. So I appreciate what you're trying to do, but it just doesn't work. That guy, you want a guy that like me when Knots first came out said, let me try it, let me install it. But then when he actually analyzed everything with this 110 forcing signal that's going to be added on August 8th, said, nah, I'm out. It ain't that I don't agree with your intent. I disagree with your method and reality. Then I'm going to give you a link to this guy. This guy's great, and I'll tell you a little bit about that when we get to it. Before we do, a couple things I want to tell you about today. Number one, I will be speaking on August the 29th in West Virginia. It's a Saturday. West Virginia Homeschool Association. This is in Charleston, West Virginia. And I'm also going to be staying at a hotel only about 10 minutes from the airport there. It's just on the other side of the river, so it's on the same side of the river as the airport, if you know the area. If you want to come to the event, I have an article out today about it. A ticket's $50, and if you're one person, it's $50, and if you're like mom, dad, and kids, it's $50. It's the same price for everybody. If you buy your ticket today or tomorrow, you get it for $35. After that, it goes up to the full $50. If you aren't going to come, can't come, whatever, to that event, about 6:30 in the evening at my hotel, there is a wonderful restaurant called the Brick and Salt, I believe is what it's called, Brick Salt Bar and Kitchen. It's a really great restaurant for one that's in a hotel. I picked it for that reason. And from 6:30 to 9:30, I'm going to run a meetup where you guys can come meet me, but you also can meet each other. So if you're anywhere near in around Charleston, you may want to come to that even if you don't come to the convention. During the event, I will be doing the keynote address, and it will be on homeschool education and about my journey as a homeschool grandparent with my grandchildren from year 2020 to 2025. So about 5 years we homeschooled right here. And we ended up using AI a lot in it. And if we were still doing it, I would be doing it more. And I'm going to be talking about using AI as an educational tool, not turning over the responsibility of educating people to AI. Those are very different things. But I'm also going to be talking a lot about homeschool as a thing in of itself. They gave me, I think, an hour to talk. So I'm going to do a really deep, informative presentation. And if I do say so myself, quite inspirational one as well. If you do not have kids of your own, I'm just going to say that homeschooling is something still totally worth supporting. If you are like me and you're 40, 50, 60 years old, somewhere in that range, you ain't so far from being a real senior citizen. And these kids that are learning today are the people you're going to depend on in your old age. And the more of them who are free, independent thinkers that can do self-directed learning and think for themselves, the better off we're going to be when we don't have a say anymore. Because like it or not, there's a point we reach in our lives, we stop having a say. We're born without a say, we grow up, we have a say, and eventually we tend not to anymore. And so we need to think about who's going to have that say. And there's a lot of other reasons that I believe homeschooling is one of the biggest liberty movements that's ever been created. And even if you're not going to do it yourself, it is totally worth supporting and learning about. So please, if you're anywhere near that area, consider coming and learning and meeting other people who are interested in the same types of things that you are. Again, all the details are on my website. And the West Virginia Homeschool Educators Association has a Facebook page I've linked to out of there where you can learn more about their work. And I would love to meet you. I'd love to have a beer with you and chat with you. And I always love doing meetups. Not just because you guys get to come meet me, but I get to see you guys meeting each other. Because if you're going to come to this, odds are you're not going to drive across the country for a 3-hour meetup or even a homeschool convention in West Virginia. So odds are most of the people there will at least be from somewhere around the area, and that gives you guys the opportunity to network and continue to associate with each other after I'm long gone. Real quick, too, and I said this in the article, just to say this before I wrap up. If you live in West Virginia, please do not send me, because I'm just going to have to tell you no. Don't send me an email saying, I want you to come by my house. I want you to come see my farm. I want you to come have dinner. I want to buy you dinner. I appreciate it. I am literally flying in, and I'm not getting there till late in the afternoon on Friday. I am going straight to my hotel. I'm doing final prep work because I have to do a good job for these people. They're paying me to do this. I have contracted with them to do a fantastic job, so you know I'm going to deliver. So I'm not going to be up late. I'm not going to be drinking. I'm not traveling around. I'm going to my hotel. I'm settling in. I'm getting all my stuff ready for the morning, and I'm going to bed. I'm waking up. The thing starts at 9. I'm going to be there at least by 8. I'm going to be there 9 to 5. I'm going to come back to my hotel room. I'm going to take a shower and chill and be away from people for about an hour. 6:30, I'm going to head down to the bar and meet you guys. The next morning, I am getting up in the morning very early. I'm going to get in my little car, and I'm going to drive to the airport, get on a plane, come home. That is the entire trip, so it is not me not willing to spend additional time with y'all. That 3-hour block I built in there, that's the time I have. And I did that mainly because, you know, Dorothy's not going. And since Dorothy's not going, it's not a vacation and a business trip. It is pure business, and that means Dorothy is here without me. And she has to take care of this place without me in the heat of summer. So I thought being gone 2 nights is long enough for her to do that. All right, with that, let's go ahead and dig on into this and start off with Dr. Ron Paul. And might I remind you, not that it really applies so much here today, but it does in dealing with a person like Fauci that tells him he's dumb and he doesn't know what he's talking about. Dr. Rand Paul discussing $1.5 trillion military budget and the destruction of the United States dollar.
The headline is Hegseth says no, says not giving the Pentagon $1.5 trillion. Pretty soon it's going to be a lot of money. He claims it's the greatest threat facing the U.S. So my question would be, why doesn't he reduce the threat to the United States? Does he have any authority? Wouldn't he have a military to maybe reduce it?
He actually has it completely upside down. The greatest threat to the United States is our debt right now. We're not really in danger of having an adversary invade the United States. We're in danger of destroying the dollar. And so $1.5 trillion would be a 50% increase in 1 year. So we currently spend about $1 trillion on the military. We currently have about $1 trillion in interest on the debt. So if you increase it to $1.5 trillion, that's a 50% increase in 1 year. And in addition, they want to do a $500 billion increase in 1 year. But then he says, oh, I need $37 billion for emergency spending to buy more bombs to bomb Iran. And it's like, so they went $537 billion. He says it's an emergency and difficult for the country if they don't do it. I think it's the opposite. If we do spend that kind of money, if we do borrow that kind of money, I think that's what threatens our country.
Well, you've had some suggestions where you suggest that cutting a little bit every year in a scheme of things, it looks like a little bit. But if you do it for a while and you actually cut something, we could probably work our way back into a sensible position. But the odds don't seem very good that you're going to get that passed.
For years, we were advocating for what was called the penny plan. If you cut 1% across the board of everything, you could actually balance in about a five-year period. We chose 5 years because the constitutional amendment to balance the budget was a five-year process. But it got worse. We had the COVID spending. Remember, they shut all the economy down. They gave everybody free money. Everybody got a $2,000 check, $2,500 check to everybody. Well, because of that now, if you want to cut across the board, it would be a 6% cut across the board, including the military, and you could balance in 5 years. But realize that's what I'm proposing, a 6% cut. They're proposing a 50% increase. So I'm saying you would have to cut everything 6% to balance. They want to do a 50% increase. It is fiscally irresponsible, and really it's the opposite of what he's saying. And it really points out the question, is there anyone left in the Republican Party who is fiscally conservative? I will vote against that. I'll vote against the NDAA, but I'm also going to vote against the emergency spending as well. I said I'll consider it if it's paid for by cuts somewhere else, but they're saying we should never pay for war spending. It should always be borrowed.
Yeah, that's right.
So this is where I agree 100% with sentiment, but I disagree on the reality. The only thing you're doing at this point with the dollar is perhaps in some ways, maybe possibly a little bit, slowing down the demise of the dollar that's already dying and dead. And I don't actually mean that when I say that the way that people would take it, in that I do not mean that the dollar is just going to drop, blow away, and go away. I mean that there is a one-way path to the value of the dollar, and the only question is how steep the decline is at any given period of time. There is no fixing this. Let's say that all of a sudden, all of the Congress and the Senate House of Representatives both, they just all had to come to Jesus moment and said, oh my goodness, Rand Paul is right. Let's cut everything 6% across the board. First, we all know that's not going to happen. And let's say somehow the orange man who loves just never met a dollar he don't want to spend says, I agree, and signs it into law. And let's say we actually did it. For a long enough period of time, the budget now balances. You know what happens? The monetary expansion continues anyway. And eventually we go, oh, we need more stuff. And the cost of things goes up because the dollar's already devalued. And what gets always left out of these discussions that commit the sin of leaving hope for the hopeless, right, which kind of ties into my Biplan 10 segment at the end today, is that it gets people hypnotized by this idea that we can fix this. There is no fixing this the way that it is. You either have a fiat, debt-backed currency that declines in value across time, okay, or you have a hard money. You either have abundant money and scarce resources, or scarce money and abundant resources. There is no option C. I often say you always should ask about a third option at least. I literally have one of my books, one of the mental code rewrites, is when presented with a binary choice, I'll always seek a third option before deciding. But sometimes when you look for the third option, it's not there. The only other option would be to have a fiat currency that works like ours does, run by a responsible government. When you find Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, and Sasquatch riding a unicorn over the rainbow, let me know and we'll have that discussion. Anyway, moving on. Now let's talk with Kerry Brown about finding, using, and harvesting elderberry.
Hey, TSP community, this is Kerry with Strong Roots Resources. And I hope you guys don't mind a little bit of background noise today, because I'm coming to you from my pool, because it's 105 degrees, no joke, here in Knoxville. And I'm not from Texas. And Texas, Jack, you need to come get your weather. Okay, so Ryan wrote in, and he was asking, how can I find and utilize wild elderberry? He said, I would like to start harvesting wild elderberry from parks, roadways, riverbanks, etc. for medicinal uses. What are some good and easy ways to identify large patches of elderberry from a distance? And what are some ways to reduce the chances of collecting berries that may have been sprayed with or exposed to herbicide? So I'm happy to answer this for y'all. My off-the-cuff suggestion is, know when they're flowering, because that's one of the easiest times to really identify them. Here in the southeast, that's gonna be mid-May through about right now, because right now they're switching from flower mode to berry-making mode. You are looking for big clusters of white flowers. I'm talking like the size of a dinner plate. They're ample, they're noticeable, and once you train your eye a little bit, you will see them as soon as you get out of the city, as soon as you get out of manicured suburbia. We're looking for unmanaged areas that hopefully don't get sprayed. We'll address that in a minute. And areas that maybe they just get the big boom mower from time to time, or maybe they're not bothered at all. So I see them all the time. I mean, I drove up to Rogersville, Tennessee today, and I saw them everywhere on the sides of the road. So maybe a little bit of a flippant answer, but get out there and start driving around. Know what you're looking for first. And when I say big flowers, I'm not joking. They can be, I'm kind of looking at mine right now. They are 10, 12 inches across, the flower clusters. They become a little bit harder to identify currently, so the berries are small and green, so they kind of really blend in with the rest of the foliage. But they do have these purplish-pink stems that kind of give you a contrast to look for. Now, when we're talking about herbicides and stuff, again, if you are in more manicured areas, HOAs, if you're adjacent to any kind of industry, industrial park, stuff like that, there is a greater chance that herbicide or something gross has been used on or around them. So initially, my first thought is to just try to avoid that. Look for areas where nobody has any reason to use that stuff. This is kind of hit and miss, but it's kind of worth mentioning. Power line and gas line easements sometimes can be a very good place to harvest these, because you will generally have two edges, generally what most municipalities or utilities will do is they'll just come through about once a year and bush hog or something of the sort. If there is herbicide used, it is usually very obvious. You will see a lot of dead stuff. You will see a lot of brown when you shouldn't be seeing brown stuff. And so that's your cue. And generally speaking, it's not too hard to find out, to call up these companies. If you've got an easement that's on your property or near your property or your neighbor or something like that, power lines and gas line easements, find out how they manage. These companies are pretty accustomed to answering these kind of questions these days. We have a gas line easement that cuts across a portion of our property, and herbicide use has never been a thing here. I am on a, easy phone call text basis with the crew leader that manages that for the gas line. He knows that I graze sheep. He knows that we are regenerative and organic up here. And we've even gotten to the point where our portion, the portion that actually runs across our property, they don't even mow it anymore. They just skip it, and then they go on to the part south of us. And like I said, maybe once a month they mow, and I have made sure that they don't spray, because there is some stuff through there that is worth foraging. And I check that area out from time to time, because this particular easement just kind of runs through a unutilized area that's adjacent to an apartment complex. So, you know, train your eye first. Know what herbicide use looks like. And generally they spray, I mean, here's the thing about herbicide use. There's no rule that says they're going to spray it when it's actually supposed to be effective. So if you see big browning, yellowing streaks, that's late application. It's been a while since things were applied. If you see sudden wilting in a certain strip and everything else kind of beyond that looks okay, that is certainly something to look out for. I don't really know much about mitigating. I don't really know how well that stuff can be washed off. I know when it comes to other kind of potential contaminants, you know, water on its own is a solvent, and water combined with a few drops of povidone iodine can also make things a lot safer to consume. Once you have collected your berries, it's very easy to do this. You want to cut the whole cluster off. Don't worry about picking off individual berries. They're very soft. They'll crush. You'll just wind up kind of painting your hands. So clip the whole cluster off. Take you some big roomy, I actually really like paper grocery bags for this. Drop it into the grocery bags. Roll them up a little bit. Take them home to your freezer. Stuff them in the freezer. Leave them in there for, I mean, as long as you need to. But for, you know, in an hour or so, they're going to freeze enough that you can pull those clusters back out and you can just shake them right onto, you know, a sheet or a tablecloth or something, and have those berries ready to be otherwise frozen or processed into syrup, dried for your teas and so forth. Those are some of the easy ways to use them. So I hope that's useful to you guys, and I will talk to you next time.
I just listened to every single word of that before I continued on producing the show for you guys today. I wanted to make sure he had the freezer trick in there. That is the best thing I've ever learned about elderberries. I don't grow them here anymore. I used to grow them on my own property, and for when I was making a lot of mead back in the day, one of my favorite meads was elderberry mead, and that made it doable. That is the single best hack for elderberry foraging there is. Once those things are frozen, you can knock them right off, and they don't stain or anything like that. And I would add this. I usually throw them, I have deep chest freezer, so I usually throw them in a 5-gallon bucket, and I'll throw a whole bucket in there at once. And if you take that bucket out and start knocking them off, what'll end up happening is by the time you're halfway through that bucket, they'll start to defrost. So when I'm doing that, I'll lift the thing, grab a handful of them, get those off, and I usually just put them in another bucket, and then I go grab, and I keep them in the freezer while I'm doing it, and it just works a lot better that way. All right, now let's hear about Nutsedge from Nick Ferguson. This is another one I'll listen to see if he gives you my solution to Bermuda grass. So I'd be surprised if he didn't, one, because I'm sure he knows it, and two, because he was just here taking care of my garden for about a week and a half. So let's go ahead and hear from Nick on that.
Hey there, Nick Ferguson here with a question from Michael on gardening. This one is for Nick. Location, Middle Tennessee. Garden is overrun with nutsedge, looking for options. Have had this garden plot since 2018, been building soil on top of rocky clay with wood chips. Now it's being taken over by nutsedge and Bermuda. From reading about killing nutsedge, it seems like that it's not for gardens, as it will make the soil toxic for 3 years and not suitable for growing. Would love some ideas, solutions. Currently only interested in tomatoes and peppers. Also have some nice stands of comfrey growing, picture for reference. Should I just give up or try something else? All right, so my question for you is, how many tomatoes and peppers do you really need? Can you get away with just putting in a couple raised beds and growing in, like, some great soil with no nut grass rhizomes? Because, honestly, that's probably what I'd do. I'd throw in a couple nice raised beds, fill them with good soil mix, and just go to town. Put my tomatoes and peppers in there, and then I would start working on the nutsedge fiasco. So for that garden area where you're dealing with that nutsedge invasion, I want you to take proper soil samples. Send them off to Logan Labs. Order a basic with extras. Should be around $32. If you have excess carbonates in your soil, You can do a phys test. You can just look that up, how to do a phys test. It's just a couple tablespoons of soil and a tablespoon of 5% vinegar, and see if it gets all fizzy and bubbly. If it's fizzy and bubbly, then you are going to need the ammonium acetate test, which is an extra $32. But I'd be kind of surprised if you were dealing with that. Then you'll really know what you're working with. I bet you the entirety of my Bitcoin wallet that you have serious mineral imbalances in your soil if you're dealing with a lot of nutsedge. So either learn how to balance your soils yourself just by doing the research, or put in a request for me to generate a report and recipe to start fixing the soils that you have. Typically, it takes around 3 to 5 years to get your soils mineral balanced. In my experience, those pest weeds just stop showing up. When you get it balanced, they just disappear. They're gone. They just don't germinate anymore. Neil Kinsey has a great book called Hands-On Agronomy, and Michael Astra has a good one called The Ideal Soil Volume 2. I really like that book. So while you're getting the mineral imbalances fixed, I would apply some organic matter and tarp it with either clear greenhouse plastic and solarize this summer. That's going to kill as much nutsedge as possible with non-toxic methods. Or you can use an opaque film like a billboard tarp or silage tarp, and then you can just cover that and just leave it for months and months and months. If you want to go nuclear, then you could herbicide the area, but I'm not a big fan of that kind of solution. But your mileage may vary. You can do what you want to with that. Or you just hit the easy button. Send me the data you get from Logan Labs, and I'll get you a custom mineral blend for your year one journey. And we can set up follow-up stuff for consecutive years while you're moving production to raised beds for a couple years. That should get you your tomatoes and peppers and everything productive for the short term, and also deal with the long-term mineral imbalance that I guarantee you're going to find if you actually test your soil. Great question. Keep them coming. I'm Nick Ferguson with Homegrown Liberty. Do good things.
So what I was going to suggest is weed blocker, but if this is in the ground, it will only be so effective. What I did this year is I took the heaviest weed blocking material I could get, and since I have raised beds, I actually staple, I didn't put it into the ground with the ground staples. I literally stapled it to the bed itself, and I only made holes where I planted things. And that worked dramatically well because I have way too much, not nutsedge, but Bermuda grass. And the beautiful thing about nutsedge is what Nick said. If you get your soil super fertile and minerally balanced and all, it kind of goes away. Bermuda grass gets excited about really deep, delicious, nutritious soil. Bermuda grass is not a weed. It's a grass. And it is actually a valuable grass if you're doing things like grazing. It's just not what I want in my garden. So I would just add to it, if you go the raised bed route, which is kind of the super easy button at the beginning, where you're doing that, throw in some raised beds and add soil, and you don't have to put the weed blocker down at the bottom of the bed. I wish to God I had done that. And I knew that was a good idea, and I just didn't do it. And if y'all remember, I put the beds in we're talking about in while I had a workshop going on here. And you tend, when you do things as part of a workshop, sometimes you tend to leave things out to try to keep the process moving that you really shouldn't. And that was just a mistake. And if I could go back and do it, I would. And I actually lined those beds, the inside of them vertically, with weed blocker to help protect the timbers, to give longer life to them. And for some other reasons, and it would have been really easy to buy a couple more rolls of it and just cover the ground where we built them. So that's advice for everybody. I try to make sure even when we're given specific responses, we make the response as universal as possible. If you put raised beds in, please, for the love of God, spend the money on the weed blocker and put the weed blocker underneath the bed before you fill it. It will make your life so much easier. And that means even as you correct some weed issues, at least they won't be re-infiltrating from the bottom. With that, let's move on. Next one that we have for you today is going to be on mushrooms, cooking them at something called mushroom water, from Chef Ken Daniels.
Hello all, Chef Ken here. Today we're going to do a quick mini-series on mushrooms because the emails have been coming in. I'll break down what I consider the two most important factors in cooking mushrooms. Today's segment will be about mushrooms and water. Today's question comes from Jerry. Jerry writes, Chef Ken, what's the best way to cook blue oysters, pink oyster mushrooms, and lion's mane? Every time I cook these mushrooms, they come out rubbery. Jerry, I have to tell you, I have been getting back into mushrooms, but the TSP community has been on fire with this topic, so I will be amping up all my experiments and coming up with some more tips soon. And really, that's what I was taught by some great chefs I apprenticed under. This is years ago. It's not recipes, it's experimenting. I stand on the shoulders of some great chefs that I've seen fail a lot. So that's number one, learn to experiment. Don't be afraid to fail at cooking these things. It's like butchery. Most chefs can cook meat, but put a side of beef in front of them and ask for a specific cut. It's just ugly. To me, venturing into these projects and learning in depth is making me a better chef every day. So the same goes for mushrooms. Every time I cook mushrooms, I'm assuming that I was overcooking them. Then I thought I wasn't cooking them long enough. I tried more butter, less butter, cast iron, stainless steel, higher heat, lower heat. Every batch seemed to teach me something different, but none of them solved the problem completely. Then one day I realized I really wasn't experimenting. I was just changing random things. So I started over. And every time I cooked them, I was only going to change one variable, nothing else. Same pan, same butter. Change one thing and pay attention. And now you're really kind of getting insight into how I do my culinary experiments. Is I do this kind of in a scientific method. And that's how really good chefs learn. We don't become better because we memorize recipes. We become better because we start noticing patterns. And the first pattern I noticed with mushrooms was water. Fresh, fancy mushrooms are mostly water, and depending on the variety, they're somewhere between 85 to 90% moisture. And that is an astonishing amount when you stop and think about it. Every mushroom you put into a skillet is carrying around its own little like reservoir of water, and until a good portion of that water leaves, the mushroom isn't really frying, it's steaming itself. And that realization completely changed how I approached them. So instead of asking, how do I cook this mushroom? I started asking, can I get rid of some of that water before it even hits the stove? And the easy experiment was simply changing how I stored them. So have you ever bought mushrooms? I mean, some of you guys do grow and that's great, but most of us go out to a store and buy these fancy mushrooms. And you open this plastic container that's been underneath the mist of the grocery store all day. And you found these little beads of water all over the inside. That's condensation. Mushrooms are still alive after they harvest. They continue to breathe. And if you trap them in a sealed container, moisture builds up. So immediately after buying, I started moving them into paper bags or cracking the package just enough to let the air circulate. It wasn't dramatic, but it was measurable. And the mushrooms felt drier and they browned just a little sooner. Then I wondered what would happen if I pushed the idea a little farther, right? Instead of waiting for the refrigerator to do work naturally, I spread the mushrooms out on a wire rack and left them uncovered overnight. Again, it wasn't trying to dehydrate them. I wasn't trying to make mushroom chips. I simply wanted to circulate air inside the refrigerator to pull a little surface moisture away before the mushrooms ever touched the skillet. Then I had probably my strangest idea. I looked over at my air fryer. I wanted moving air. So I set the fryer to its lowest temperature, I don't know, somewhere around 120, and I popped the basket open just enough so that the moisture could escape instead of recirculating moist air inside the machine. Did it work? Yeah, I think it did. The lion's mane browned faster afterwards, and I thought the texture improved. Was it a night and day difference? No, not yet. Would I call it a proven technique? Yeah, definitely not yet. The next rabbit hole I went down involved my freezer. Now, this one actually has some science behind it. So when you freeze food, ice crystals form inside the cell. Those crystals rupture cell walls, which is one reason frozen fruit and vegetables often become softer after thawing. I started wondering if I could use that to my advantage with mushrooms. So I froze an entire lion's mane. The next day, I thawed it slowly in the refrigerator. Then I gently pressed it between clean towels. The amount of water that came out surprised me. The mushroom was completely different afterwards. Now, I wouldn't do that if I wanted a beautiful whole mushroom steak for presentation, because the texture definitely changes. But if I were making shredded lion manes for tacos or a filling for ravioli, where appearance really didn't matter nearly as much, I'd absolutely use that technique again. But I can tell you what I've observed in my own kitchen. The torn edges brown more aggressively. They develop little nooks and ridges that crisp really beautifully, and I found myself wondering if opening those natural fibers gave moisture a shorter path out of the mushroom while also creating more surface area for browning. Whether that's exactly what's happening or not, I honestly don't know. But I know what I've seen every time I cook them. And finally, I started playing with an experiment that I'm still not ready to call successful: vacuum sealing. Now, I'm not pulling a hard commercial vacuum that crushes the mushrooms into pancakes. It's just enough suction to slightly compress them before freezing. And my hypothesis is that a slight compression followed by freezing may encourage a little more cellular breakdown while still preserving enough structure to produce a better texture during cooking. I've only run that experiment a handful of times, and the jury is still out. So, in the next series, we'll be learning how to cook different types of mushrooms after we've pushed the water out. There's a technique in the cooking that is going to expel much more water than I could ever do before the cook. But I'd like to give as much of that water a chance to get out before I even hit the fire. And I really do think you're going to like the second series. Jerry, I hate to break this up into two bits, but I love your question. And in fact, everyone's questions that have been coming in about mushrooms. Keep them all coming in. You can find me at bloodsugarchef.com. And until next time, this is Ken, your Blood Sugar Chef. Cheers.
You know, on the moisture thing on mushrooms, I'm going to tell you that when you realize how much moisture is in a mushroom, the most isn't when you cook it. It's when you dehydrate it. It's amazing what a giant pile of mushrooms turns into when you remove almost all the water by throwing them either in a solar dehydrator. You can, many mushrooms, you can just cut them and put them out in the sun, especially this time of year if you live in a drier climate, or you throw them in an Excalibur or something. The amount of reduction is just unbelievable. Next up, let's hear from Annie McCann on plantar fasciitis. And I can tell you from experience, this one can be painful.
Hello and good morning. This is Andy McCann coming to you from Woodstock, Georgia, where I own CrossFit Garage. I am an engineer by degree, and I love to troubleshoot. I got into this fitness world because everyone seems to die too early. And how do you troubleshoot that? Well, movement is medicine, and I love this stuff. So if you need help with movement or food or that sort of thing, that health and fitness and nutrition, I'm your guy. I've got a lot of coaches that work for me. You can hire them. They work remote. The question I got today is, this is an easy one for me. Andy, what about plantar fasciitis? How do I help my foot? I can't walk in the morning. There was more stuff that came with it. We text or email back and forth. But it's that plantar fascia, the bottom of your foot crimps up, and you're like, this really freaking hurts. How do I get out of this? There are a lot of things that people say to do. The dumbest one I tried was coffee sock. It doesn't work. Coffee grains in your sock, it didn't do anything. The other two I have actually had proof of from either myself or other people, and I'm going to give those to you, and I'll link the products over to Jack to share. The not-so-successful one for me but worked for many people is lemongrass oil. So I think the thing on this one is you need to make sure it's like strong and pure, and it does turn your foot sort of like different color, but basically you lather the bottom of your foot up with this lemongrass oil, and it does whatever it does. I don't know why it works. It's like, you know, putting onions on your ears to get rid of an ear infection. I don't know really what's happening. I just know that my wife has prescribed, not prescribed, my wife has mentioned this with, she does doTERRA oils, and she will help people with plantar fasciitis, and they'll put it on their foot. You know, make sure you wear a sock because it gets everywhere. And like a week later, they're like, yep, it's gone. I feel great. And she's like, yeah, keep doing it. How long you do it? I don't know. I guess if it comes back, do it again. But that tends to work for people. It did not work for me. What did work for me is something called Heel Seats, HEELSEATS. So Heel Seats. And yeah, I thought this is dumb. It's not going to work. Basically, the heel seat, and I'm going to link this over there. I have them in all of my shoes. What it does is it kind of puts a pencil across the front section of your heel. So where the plantar, that fascia, that tendon is, it's going to continually push on it with like just a little bit, like a pencil's worth of push. And so this thing goes where your heel would go with a little bump at that end right on the heel. And at first it feels like, wow, this is a really big rock in my shoe. Then over time, you don't even notice it. Actually, I notice it when my feet or my shoes don't have this. So this heel seat's pretty cool. I'm pretty sure I talked about this maybe 2 years ago, but this is it. This one, I've recommended this one out, both of these out, a lot. And it's weird. I don't know if it has something to do with hormones, but many women say that the lemongrass oil worked for them, and many guys say this heel seat worked for them. So is it, I don't know, estrogen, testosterone? I have no idea. I am definitely not a doctor, and I did not sleep at a Holiday Inn Express. All I can tell you is I have these in my shoe, and I don't have issues anymore. I used to have to get out of the bed and crawl around until my feet finally felt like they were, I don't know, not zombies. And this is the only thing that worked for me to change it. I still wear them now. Do I need to? Maybe not. But I am the type of guy, this is a weird thing, maybe too much information. I like to take the insole out of my shoe because the pad of my foot always rubs a hole in that and my sock. And I have found no insole equals no rub, and my socks last longer and my feet has more space. I like super spacey shoes. So like the toe box is really big. My toes can splay out. And I put this thing in every one of them. So you know what? I'll link you to the shoe that I buy. I just found I've been doing this shoe for about, I don't know, 2 years now. I found it on Amazon. I was like, I just need a very minimal shoe that doesn't cost much. And dang, if this thing isn't the best, I'm a zero drop type of guy. I want like minimal everything. And that's what this is. And it's $30. I thought, I'll give it a shot. So far, the best shoe I've ever put on for everyday use. I even actually work out in it. Let me find that shoe. Oh, I'm going to butcher the name here. It is WHITIN, Witten, men's wide barefoot sneaker for optimal relaxation. I don't know if it doesn't make me relax, but it's only $30 or $40. Lots of colors. And anyway, so I use these. I know the question is going to come up. Well, Andy, but what shoe? The shoe doesn't matter. I just like these. Put the heel seat in it and you'll feel the push. It's going to take probably a week or two for it finally to do its thing. But I think the way this is working, right, it's just pushing on that tendon ever so slightly all the time, giving it a reason to elongate. Again, your body is the ultimate adaptation machine. It will adapt to the stimulus or the stresses you put on it. This is a stress you're putting on it, and it's saying, hey, elongate that tendon, that fascia, whatever. And it does. It does the trick. So anyway, these are the things that I use. The shoes, I don't think really matter, but I like them. They're inexpensive, and they, good Lord, last forever. I mean, I've had the same shoe for over a year, and I use it all the time. I have another one sitting on the shelf, ready to go. That's how I work. One is one, and two is two, or whatever. So I have the second shoe ready to go. Anyway, guys, I could probably find the answer if you have a thing, because being in the business of health and fitness for so long, the questions come up. If you're at your rope's end with diet, nutrition, food, and all that, man, I've got people that'll help. If you're at the end with, I just don't know what to do, I've got people that will help. My email address is andy@crossfitgarage.com. You can go to our website, crossfitgarage.com. I will have you hire these guys directly. I liked to, the rising tide lifts all boats. So I always try to coach with them and then bring them business, help them out, because they're also lifting the business of our gym. And so I want them to find those rewards. So I know, like, and trust all these guys and hire them myself. All right, y'all take care.
So I just have a real brief addition on this one. And there's a weird thing about plantar fasciitis, and he hit on it there at the beginning, the guy that asked the question, that, you know, your feet hurt in the morning. And that's the weird thing. Like, you go to bed and you feel fine and you didn't do anything in bed, and you get out of bed in the morning, or if you have to get up in the middle of the night to take a pee or something, and it hurts. It's like you feel like you injured it. And I guess in a way it is an injury, but it's not an acute injury. It's a chronic injury. And so you wake up in the morning and your foot hurts, and you deal with it as best you can. And then you get through the day for a while, and it kind of like from using the foot and putting stretch on that tendon, it starts to hurt less and less. And you think, well, I must have done something and I realize it. So I'll go back to bed tonight and rest it, and then it'll be better. And it hurts again. It hurts worse. And so once I told my wife what was going on, she said, oh, this is what it is. And my son, his wife, my daughter-in-law, had dealt with it, and they told me about some compression socks for plantar fasciitis that you can get on Amazon. They're really inexpensive, and they are really compression-oriented toward that arch. And I'm like, well, shit, I'll try anything. So I ordered some, and it made a difference right away, and within a week I wasn't dealing with it anymore, and I wore them for like another week, and then I took them off, and I've never put them on again, but I saved them, and they're in my drawer. I'll just leave it at that. And so Andy mentioned three different items, the heel seats, the lemongrass oil, and the shoes. Those I have for you in the show notes today under his bullet point. And I also have compression socks, and this is Jack's recommendation, not Annie's, just to be clear that this is something I'm recommending. And you can check those out. All right, now I got one more thing for you. I think a lot of this, and you notice the shoes that he recommended are considered barefoot shoes. And so they're basically really wide. So basically there's something you can walk with them on your feet, but it's like you're not wearing shoes. That's the goal anyway. You're basically bigger than your foot so that your foot isn't really supported, which seems like the opposite of what we want to do. And if you're hiking or something, you want ankle support, definitely. But I think a big reason we have a lot of foot problems anymore is because human beings weren't built to wear shoes. I know we have for as long as we have recorded history, and there's good reasons to it. But if you ever seen a baby come out dressed or have a pair of shoes on, we as a species evolved to run around naked. We just didn't like some of the consequences of that, so we built compensation mechanisms. What am I saying? I'm saying if you work from home like I do, take your damn shoes off. You know, I understand why we wear shoes outside. The things are dirty, you step on things, you get your feet cut, sandburrs, walking on poop, etc. Hopefully none of that stuff's in your house. So when you're at home, kick the dadgone shoes off. You know, socks are fine. And walk around and bear weight with your whole foot like your body was designed to do. And I believe that'll help a lot. And I don't think it's a coincidence that this happened to me in the winter. And it was a pretty cold winter this year where I was not doing that. So I kind of made a conscious effort to do more of that. And I think that's part of the problem. All right. So let's talk about this BIP 110 thing. Jesse did a really great segment a while back on knots, which is kind of sort of the origin of it. Bitcoin knots was you could basically run that code on a Bitcoin node other than running Bitcoin core. And so that was something. I even installed Knots for a while and played with it to see what it did. And from a user standpoint, it's not much different. And what it did is your node simply did not filter any sort of spam. And that's relative to who thinks what is spam in the blockchain. In other words, there are ways, I won't get into how, that you can basically embed data into a Bitcoin transaction. And remember that all the data that makes images, videos, everything that we see on the internet is just ones and zeros. So right out of the gate, since Bitcoin is data, there will always be data, and there's always going to be like some additional amount of room to add additional data, because that way you can do things like put a note on a transaction. And this goes back so far that you go back to like the time of the block war. So we're like, you know, almost 10 years ago now, 2017, when Craig Wright, after the whole Roger Ver debacle with Bitcoin Cash, when Craig Wright came out with Bitcoin Satoshi Vision and claimed he was the real Satoshi, somebody, I guess Satoshi's still around, because one of the original blocks that we believe was mined by Satoshi, somebody didn't even move a sat. They just planted an inscription, and it said, Craig is a liar, right? If you can put a little bit of text, You can put pieces of code to make an image. And an important thing to understand every, like when I go through all this, to understand what that means is you can spread out information across multiple transactions and still have a way, a viewing tool that will compile things and you will see things like images. Okay? There's no way to stop data being put and added into the Bitcoin blockchain unless you restrict it so much that it can't actually be Bitcoin anymore. So no matter what we do, spam will always be a problem. But what really upset some of this group that's known as the plebs, and they're basically people that nobody knows, and they call themselves the plebs, was about a year ago, a little less than about 10 months ago, I guess, 9 months ago, something like that. Bitcoin Core made a change to something called OP Return. And you don't need to know what that is to understand that the big change they made is they made it where it could hold a larger amount of data. And they basically set it up so if you were going to insert data, you would do it there. And I'll talk about why they did that in a minute. But that's the change. And when that happened, there was a large number of people, they were calling them Nazis, but K-N-O-T-Z, Nazis at the time, that were running Bitcoin Knots, that got really, really, really pissed because now what they said is you open the door to spam. There is no door. The door was always open. But they actually made a bigger place and an easy place to stick your spam, and they did it in a way that took pressure off the blockchain. Okay? Because when you have to cut up your pictures and shit and put it in multiple transactions, it actually adds more bloat to the blockchain. So the expansion of OP return actually was a solution. All right? And this enraged these people, and this developer named Luke started this idea of basically a pleb revolution, and everybody's going to install Knots in 110 onto their node, and we are going to take over the network and force a change into the network with our little, like, Start9 and Umbumtu nodes. And I got no problem with Start9, their sponsor, or Umbumtu, or any of these other options. I think everybody should run a node. I run a node. And it does matter, and it does help the network to a degree. However, there's a fundamental reality here that these folks are ignoring, and it makes their little quest a quest that cannot succeed. And I'm sorry, and you know that they know it because when you say these things, they start insulting you. Here's some names I've been called since I have started to speak out on this a little bit on social media. And I'm not saying I disagree with what you want. If I could wave a wand and make all the spam go away, I would. I want every monkey JPEG deleted, okay? Or whatever else, and some nasty stuff too, right? I don't want any of it. But I'm also a realist to say, like, data is data, okay? When you look at a Bitcoin node, what you're looking at is a little device, and what it does is it holds the entirety of the Bitcoin blockchain. You can have what's called a prune node too, but let's talk about a full node. That means that every transaction ever is in a record on a little box somewhere. It can be on a computer. There's a lot of ways you can make them. And all the data of every transaction ever is in that blockchain. You have a copy of it. And then your node sits there and it listens. And then we have these things called blocks. They have about 10-minute increments. And that's when the miners are doing their thing and they're verifying transactions. People think miners are there to make more Bitcoin. That's a byproduct. What they're doing is when Harry sends Sally a Bitcoin transaction, they verify it. And when they find the block and it all gets verified, the miner, or in this case really mining pool, that found that block and verified all the transactions in that block gets a block reward. That is an amount of Bitcoin that goes in half every 4 years. That's, if you ever heard the halving, that's what that is. And that's mining in that they get Bitcoin in return for their service. But what they're really doing is verifying transactions. And all the nodes listen, and all the nodes agree and say, this is the block that I saw. This is valid. It comes together, and the majority of nodes rule. And then that becomes the official block. It gets added to the top of the chain, and the whole thing starts all over again. And that's how we know where Bitcoin is, who sent it to whom, and now we don't know names. We know numbers, addresses, right? And the person that now Sally not only has the Bitcoin, it shows up in her wallet, she now has the authority, once that block is finalized, to spend it. And then the mining also makes sure that nobody can take it away from Sally unless she's stupid and gives up her private key. That's how they work. Now, for years, we have told people that are new to Bitcoin that want to get beyond just exchange or software wallet or even a hardware wallet, but using somebody else's node. If you want full sovereignty, run your own node, then you have control and you have sovereignty over your own Bitcoin. You really are your own bank, and you're helping to secure the Bitcoin network. This is all true, but the truth can easily be pushed into fiction. So here's the reality of how Bitcoin was coded. Satoshi made it very easy for anybody to help secure Bitcoin, but very difficult for even a large group of people to change it. Changing it requires consensus. Somewhere along the way, these plebs have been convinced by influencers, the ones that want this thing, even though they know it can't be and it's not going to happen, but they like leading a revolt, I guess, or they're in some fantasy land where they believe in themselves, I don't know, that one node equals one vote on the Bitcoin network. And if you can just get 55% of the node signaling a thing, then everybody just has to go along. Now, that number is actually usually higher with something. This is what's called a user-activated soft fork. You don't really need to know that, but just for the technical people listening, waiting to get me a gotcha here. That's usually a much higher threshold for that to get activated. Somehow they were able to do this with 55% under some sort of emergency bullshit or something, and they actually think that they can get there, which they're not going to. You can't do this, but the reality is, what Satoshi never said was one node, one vote. This is the man or group of people, or it could be a woman, I doubt it, just because I do. Don't get upset with me, I just don't really think this is a woman that did this. It could be a group of people, though. And when the person that codes it says a thing, you should probably listen. Not so much what they want it to be, but what it is. That you can rely on. So one CPU, one vote, is what Satoshi said. Now, you have to take yourself back to about 2009 and understand, you could take kind of a junky old laptop when this thing first started, and you could start mining, and you could have success. And then later, that went to GPUs, like people were using gaming computers as the difficulty level went up. And then eventually, it went to what we call an ASIC, which is a specialized computer that serves one purpose, mine Bitcoin. Secure transactions. That's the only thing an ASIC does. And they're incredibly powerful for what they are. And we keep making newer versions of them with more power, what's called hash power. They are the ones that secure the network. They all run nodes of their own. And they are going to fulfill their blocks to the monetary nodes. Now, what the person that supports 110 will say is, how do you know a monetary node from a non-monetary node? Is there anything happening there? So Billy buys himself a little node off the shelf, $500-$600, plugs it in, gets it running. He even attaches his wallet to it. But he has no economic activity. Maybe once a week he takes self-custody of something off an exchange, or he buys some eggs or tacos in El Salvador or something, okay? But he doesn't really do much with it. Okay, the miner doesn't care about his node. I don't mean a person. I mean the mining pool itself. The technology doesn't care. The miners are going to take the signals from the nodes that have high economic activity. And the people that run the mining pools and the people that individually run miners and shit like that, they're not going to mine something that may cost them money out of an ideology. In other words, if they switch over to this and not enough of the mining pool does, you're creating this soft fork, supposed to be backwards compatible, but what can happen is you think you want to block, but the rest of the signals on the active part of the network say, no, you didn't, and you don't have shit. You just think you do until you try to spend it and it won't go nowhere. It won't work. Because the majority of the network's still saying the real Bitcoin's over here, not over there. So all they have to do right now, all the miners, all the exchanges, and I'll talk about how it works with software, but all like the software providers, all of this, all they have to do right now is nothing, and they're fine, and nothing happens to them. Or out of, and they all have said, we don't want anything to do with this fight. We're leaving it alone. So they've stated their intention, and to fulfill their intention, they have to do nothing, and if they do nothing, they have no risk. You understand that, okay? Now, real quick, why wallet providers fall into this? Wallet providers, like a software wallet, like an Exodus or an Electium or something like that, which is what the majority of Bitcoin people using self-custody do. They don't run a node of their own. They use somebody else's node, and there's nothing wrong with that, right? Is it full self-sovereignty? No, but your Bitcoin is incredibly secure. As long as you have your seed phrase, you can get it back. The node is only being used for your purposes for sending and receiving. Okay, and so that when your wallet is connected, it can see a balance. That's all that it's doing. And so they have. If you think about how many customers does Nunchuck, how many customers does Exodus or what have you or Electium have? And the answer is lots of them. So their node is processing massive numbers of transactions too. So the miners, again, are going to satisfy the nodes that have economic activity. This is not because I say so. This is not opinion. This is literally how Bitcoin works. There is no way around this. You can't change this. This is reality. Now, you could change it, but you need the people that I'm talking about to partake in the change. So when you hear people ringing and screeching and yelling and still bringing up Roger Ver and still bringing up Craig Wright and the exchanges and the miners control Bitcoin – yes. Yes. Now, they don't control it into the fact that they can just change it anytime they want to, but they have immense power to block change or to embrace change because they're the ones with the economic stake. It was built that way. It's stealing Bitcoin. It's hijacking it. It's the way it was coded. It's how the incentives work. Bitcoin was designed to be like one of the superheroes that when the other superhero attacks it, he just takes its power. To be a honey badger. To not give a shit. To be boring. To not be changed frequently. To be much harder to get a change done on than to amend the Constitution. That's how it was designed. Now, what was the whole thing with expanding OP return? What Core did was say, okay, there is spam, and we're never going to get rid of spam. We accept that. Let's give them a place to put it. If you give them a place to put it, they'll put all the spam here. So that's what they did. And I'll tell you a little analogy of how this works. Back in the very early days of the show, when people still used regular forums, like bulletin board forums, we had one, the Survival Packers Forum. Still around as an archive, I believe. And we had people show up that everything was conspiracy. Conspiracy, 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 conspiracy. Even some of the stuff I obviously agreed with, but everything was conspiracy. And when anybody brought up anything, but really it's the Rockefellers, right? Like, I was talking about growing peas. Will you shut up? And I thought, well, we could ban them. But I'm like, if we ban them, they'll just create new names, new handles. If we ban them by IP, it's not real hard to use like a proxy or something. So that won't work. So I'll never get rid of these people because they're not really spammers in that they're actually using the tool in a way that it was designed to be used to convey information from one person to another. They're not dropping in like porn links or something like that, right? They're actually discussing things. Okay, fine. So we created a board called the Tinfoil Hat Club or something like that. And we made a rule. And the rule was, we will ban you if you post your conspiracy shit everywhere else. Go talk about your conspiracy shit here. And then the problem became isolated to that one location. It's not exactly the same. It is kind of like Tommy Chong, though, the same but different man. That's what's going on there. Now, the thing is, again, if we take BIP 110 and if everybody changes their mind, which they're not going to, if all the miners are like, geez, we were wrong. You called us incels, you called us suit pointers, you called us pedos just enough, Because that's how you get people to change their mind, right? If you insult somebody long enough, they'll say, oh, gee, I saw the light. You're right. You were always right. That's how these people are acting right now, because they know they're losing. So if we did that, we would go back to where Bitcoin was in 2023. When we had some 2022, 2023 is when we had some of the highest instances of ordinal spam. But you opened the door. No, you didn't open the door. You made it wider. Yeah, but we made it wider to put it in this spot. And I'm not even saying it's the perfect solution. I'm saying it's no more a problem than it ever was. Rolling this back to where they're at with this won't stop it. It won't change it. And if anybody starts bleeping at you about fees, go to Google, type in Bitcoin fee chart, and go look at fees over the past year, from October last year till now, and fees have gone in one direction, down. And by the way, fees are at all-time lows and have been for years. Go look at where the spikes are in the graph. They're nowhere near where you are now. So we don't have a fee problem. We don't have a bloated blockchain problem. And I mean, the amount of spam that can fit into the blockchain here, this isn't like the block where it's doubling the block size or something. A few bucks a year in compute, or I'm sorry, storage capacity upgrade, and you're good. Right now, if you have a 2 terabyte hard drive in your Bitcoin node, you're good for years, even if nothing changes. Okay? So this is going to fail, not because I don't like it. I'm not speaking out against it. I'm not trying to rally the troops. There's nothing to be done here. You either go ahead and you run knots with 110 and you be part of this little revolution and you convince yourself you're going to win, and then you get very disappointed come August, which isn't that far away, right? Or you don't, and you go on with your life and forget about it. On the 8th, I'm going to be floating around in the Gulf of, I guess, America, right? Mexico. It's not important to me what we call it. In the Gulf off the coast of Texas with my grandson catching big sharks. And I won't worry about this at all. I don't care. My Bitcoin is fine. So is yours. You don't have to do anything if you don't want to participate, except sit back and watch, or don't watch. You can put yourself into a coma, wake up a year from now, and you won't ever know this happened. Honest to God, that's how it is. But what happens after it fails? That's an interesting question. Now, of course, the people pushing this say, Bitcoin dies. This is dumb. We haven't had, you know, your little thing ever. Bitcoin's just fine. We don't need you. They say they want to speed up monetary adoption. Well, the change they're upset about happened last year. Why didn't we get full monetary adoption in 2023 then? Because the biggest thing holding up Bitcoin monetary adoption is lack of interest by people not part of the... See, not everybody wants to be like us, okay? And number two is tax policy. If you could spend and receive Bitcoin and treat it like dollars and only account for income, it would get spent more. It's one of the few lids the government has put on Bitcoin to hold it back. That's why there's creative ways around that. Okay? So it's not going to get adopted if this happens. What happens when it fails? Well, there's two possibilities. Possibility A is enough of these people become disillusioned, they run away, they crawl back under whatever rock they came out of, and it all goes away like it never happened. I think that's 75%. But here's the other side. This is a 25% possibility. And you don't have to care about this either, but I think it's interesting to consider. And that is that I don't believe this Luke dude, and it's like this Jr. or something. I don't know how to pronounce his last name. It looks like Dash Jr. is what it looks like. Luke is not stupid. Everything I told you, I believe this person knows. So why is he doing it anyway? To make a statement? Because he can? To cause a problem? I think it's because he went into, I don't remember what it's called now, but there's, if you want to submit a proposal for a BIP, right, which is a Bitcoin, so BIP itself is not bad. There's been many of them. Bitcoin Improvement Protocol. There's a way that Core receives. Core are the developers that actually are allowed to change Bitcoin. Okay? And they don't actually change it. They put new code out. And if the market doesn't install the code and upgrade the node and run the latest version, it stays where it is. Again, there's checks and checks and checks here. So Core can make a change and the market can just as easily as telling Luke to F off, they can tell Core to F off. So if Core makes a change and all the miners are like, yeah, we're not interested, we're not going to upgrade, we're going to stick at the level we're at, then Bitcoin stays there. You start to understand how this all put, like, Bitcoin's designed to be hard to change. So Luke knows this. So I think you might see a Roger Ver, Craig Wright moment. That if he can, if he really believes in himself, and I don't know how, because the guy's too smart. But sometimes smart people can delude themselves. They think they're Jesus or something, and they're going to lead everybody to the Bitcoin promised land. And I'm not saying he's doing that, because I honestly don't know here. I'm speculating. But if that's the case, he might get really, really angry, and they might follow the advice that a lot of people that are disinterested in this, they call us fence sitters, when they're not calling us suit coiners and, you know, page. I've been called a paid shill for the mining company. What the hell? I do not have that much influence, you retards. Okay? And again, I said I didn't want to insult them, but when you've been insulted enough, you insult back. And I'll say it right here. Not the influencers on that side of the debate that seem to be trying to walk a line. The plebs. The very vocal, obnoxious, loud people on Noster and X, they give off a big incel vibe. I'm just saying. I could be wrong. That's the feel I get from these people. And I don't mind saying that after some of the shit these people said to me over the last few months. Okay? When it fails, though, what if Luke says, okay, we tried. They clearly don't see our vision. We should keep doing this anyway. If they keep doing it, and the rest of the Bitcoin networks like F off, what happens? The soft fork becomes a hard fork. Once that soft fork differentiates itself for long enough and far enough from the main network, it's its own thing now. And you, holding your Bitcoin if you wanted to, could basically claim their coins too, just like if you were holding Bitcoin when Bitcoin Cash happened. If you knew what to do or eventually your wallet supported it, all of a sudden you had Bitcoin Cash. And if you had Bitcoin Cash when the Bitcoin Satoshi Vision split happened, all of a sudden you had Bitcoin Satoshi Vision. And if you had 5 Bitcoin Cash tokens, you had 5 Bitcoin. That same thing would happen. There's a difference here, though. Craig Wright and Roger Ver, and Roger in particular, had significant resources. Roger Ver was a Bitcoin billionaire when he made his stupid choice that Bitcoin Cash was the real Bitcoin. And he took that path. And the Bitcoin Cash debacle lasted longer than this ever could because Roger publicly stated and carried through on the idea, I'm going to sell $1 billion worth of Bitcoin fast. I'm going to drive Bitcoin through the floor and I'm going to pour all my money into Bitcoin Cash. Can you handle it? He literally said that. Do you think you can handle us? And the market went, go ahead. So he threw his tantrum. He drove the price of Bitcoin down. He drove the Bitcoin Cash price up. They got to almost the same price, a little bit higher and lower, back and forth seesaw. And then Bitcoin Cash went to shit and Bitcoin took off and did its thing like it always does at the end of a cycle. That's what happened. All right. So Luke doesn't have that. He has a bunch of angry plebs. They could still hard fork. Then for that to be worth anything, you've got to get some exchange with some liquidity to list it as a token. And then you got to get people to use it. And we should have learned this lesson, but it doesn't mean everybody has. If you can't convince the Bitcoin network to follow you when you're just modifying the existing chain, then you're not going to convince people to leave it and pick up and use your token. It's not going to happen. But I think there's a real chance that we get a hard fork out of this. Or, as like I said, people on this side of the debate have been saying, fork around and find out. All right? So what do? Nothing. I actually think there's a buying opportunity here. I think what they're going to do is they're all going to turn the little boxes on and wait for something to happen and nothing's going to happen. Because right now you can see the signal. So all of them are on. They're just not forcing the signal yet. And we can see that they have about 2%. Of signal. They need 55. They got 2. Now, some of these guys are clever. They'll go into an explorer tool, and when those signals pop up, they'll limit the timeline to just where that signal was, and they'll get to show it something like 10. But it doesn't work that way. It's across time, 2%. right? So when they realize that this isn't going to work this way, I know we'll all put some money together and we'll buy some compute and they'll buy some mining hash and they'll start throwing like $4,000 a day at it and actually mining with, they'll become a miner or a group, a small group of miners putting some hash power on the network. Well, that can only last so long. And again, if you keep doing it, all you're doing is you're widening the gap and you're turning a user soft fork into a hard fork. And then you either have to do something with it or give up and walk away. Luke has basically said, if this doesn't happen, then I'll give up and walk away. And all of the plebs behind it are saying, if this fails, Bitcoin fails. And they're not going to carry through on that either. So I'm going to tell you that it's not only not going to happen, but it's good that it's not going to happen. And that's not my opinion about spam. It has nothing to do with BIP110 itself. And if we went back to where things were in 2023, which, by the way, BIP110, I'm not going to get into it. It's way long already. But BIP110 already does more than just do that. It's not the only thing it does. And again, people have already, you can basically create a test net. And so people have already created a testnet running BIP110 and walked right through the filter with spam anyway. So it doesn't stop the spam anyway. So it's not about spam when I say this. What would it mean if like 800 to 1,200 people who are angry with no monetary real horsepower at all could just plug in a bunch of boxes, change their code, and force a change on the network? What would that mean? Well, that would mean that the government could go out at about like a good mid-tier priced off-the-shelf plug-and-play node. All you got to do is turn it on and go, right? About $600 without value shopping. That's point, click, and buy on Amazon. How much money does the federal government have? Right? How much money do people that just don't like Bitcoin but have lots of money have? Like a Peter Schiff. How many nodes could they buy, plug in, and turn on in various places? Mail it to somebody and say, look, you don't need to worry about what it does. Just plug it in, connect it to the internet, and leave it. What would that mean? Oh, I don't think there should be 21 million. It's not fair. Not everybody can have a Bitcoin that way. How many people are in the world? 8.3 billion. We need 8.3 billion Bitcoins so everybody can be a whole coiner. That's what it would mean. If you could do this with the weak ass push they have, then Bitcoin's not a honey badger. It's a bitch. If this was doable, this is not the same as what Roger did with Bitcoin Cash. It isn't. But if this was doable, that would have worked. It's good that this won't work, not because what they're trying to do is bad, because what would it mean if they could do it this way? The way they're doing it won't work, and when you tell them it won't work, they yell at you and they call you names. I have asked these people to explain to me how they will be able to do this from a technical standpoint, and every time I do that, I get insulted. What does that tell you? That they either don't know, or they do know and don't want to say it. That's what it says. Because if you ask me how something works, and I'm pro the thing, and you say, I don't think the thing works, how does it work? You guys know me after all these years. What do I tell you? It works like A, B, C, D, E, F, G, right? And I, if you are actually interested and you don't understand it, I will remix, I will add new analogies, and I will keep working till either you understand or I work myself to a point where I go, well, shit, I'm wrong. I've not heard that from any of these people. All I've heard is people like Bitcoin Mechanic saying shit like, well, if we cause enough trouble, they'll have to pay attention to us. That's not an answer. You can't overcome hash power, and you can't overcome the economic power of economic nodes that process millions and billions of dollars in transactions on a daily basis with a bunch of plug-and-play off-the-shelf boxes by people that many do not even have a freaking wallet attached to the damn things. And again, it is not a function of the intent of the node. In other words, how do we know what's a financial node and what's not a financial node? It's not about intent. It's about action. And it's very easy to see. And the miners have spoken. The exchanges have spoken. And the wallet companies have spoken.
And then I'll say the last part of it is the vast majority of people who are Bitcoiners, including people that run nodes, don't even know this is happening. They don't care. Bitcoin is supposed to be where you can put your money on a hardware wallet, put yourself in a coma for 10 years, and wake up and your money's still there. That's how it was designed to be. That's how it is. And that's the way it's going to stay. If you're angry at me right now, you're not angry at me. You're angry at reality. I'm not Fauci. I am not reality. I'm just telling you reality that you can verify for yourself. Again, I found this video, and it's really, really good. It goes deeper than I did into the actual technicals of this. The guy's a Brit, never heard of him before, don't even know his proper name. But the video, if you want to look it up for yourself on YouTube before you get a chance to find the show notes or whatever, BIP110, the plan to clean up Bitcoin. And this guy's like me. If you could make spam go away, he would. This is not about anti-censorship. It's about practicality here. And he actually makes a pretty good case for the 110 side, except that it won't work and it can't be done. If you want to understand it better because you're mad about what I said, go listen to him. Again, the guy's channel is called Bitcoin Straight Up. He published this video 2 days ago. He's obviously not a big-time influencer. He's got like 8,000 subs and 2,800 views on this video. But he's really well-informed, and he does a good job of explaining it. So if you've been wondering about this, if you're worried about this, don't. Don't. You don't have to worry about this at all because it's generally not worth worrying about. Anyway, with that, I have wrapped up another week for you guys. I hope you enjoyed it. I have a book out, some of you have heard of, Laws of Life. I actually have two Laws of Life, Book 1 and Book 2. I encourage you to pick up a copy if you haven't yet. And definitely, if you're anywhere near Charleston, check out the West Virginia Homeschoolers Convention, August 29th. I'll be there. I'll be doing the keynote. I'm going to tell you, even if you're not a homeschooler, you're going to get a lot out of it. And we do have that meetup at 6:30 to 9:30 at the Courtyard Marriott. I'm sorry, it's actually the Charleston Marriott Town Center location. And there is, again, a restaurant and bar in there called the Brick Salt Bar and Kitchen. They look like they have some fantastic food, so you can have a full meal. You can get appetizers and just have a snack, have a beer, full bar, have a mixed drink, whatever. Come meet me, some other really cool people. Sorry I went so long on that segment, but I basically said nothing about this for months now, and I wanted to be fully informed when I did, and I wanted to be able to say it once and then say, if you want to know what I think, here it is, and just have that segment available. So take care, guys. Have a great weekend. I'll catch you on Tuesday with a First Tuesday show with John and Nicole, and I'm thinking next week I may do 4 shows because I got some stuff I want to talk about, so there might be a Monday show in the coming week.
You should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.